Hey, folks, today's episode is brought to you by SunsetLakeCBD.com. They have a major end of the summer sale going on, and it's still going on. We got 13, I don't know how many days are in September. The whole month of September, it is 50% off. 50% off all hand-trimmed hemp flower smalls and kief. Matt.
Oh, yeah.
The sale runs through the end of the month of September. They're ramping up for their 2021 harvest season. So to celebrate, 50% off all of their premium hemp flower. Just use the promo code FLOWERPOWER at checkout. Now, Sunset Lake is not only a... they're not only what I call one of our movement partners. They contributed $1,000 to the Afghan refugee fundraiser that we did. They've contributed thousands of dollars to the Worcester nurses who are on strike, still on strike. They do a lot of work in their community up outside of Burlington. Great business practices, $15 minimum wage. They have great farming practices. No pesticides. They use integrated pest management, 100% organic fertilizer. They use regenerative agriculture practices. And on top of all of these things, they make a great product. Whether it's the fudge, the coffee, the gummies, the tincture with melatonin they have now.
Love that one.
That one is sweet. Whether it's the balm with arnica. They have so many different versions of CBD, folks. And, of course, they have the smalls and the keef. And that's on sale for 50% off. Use Flower Power. For everything else, left is best. One word will get you 20% off at SunsetLakeCBD.com. All right, now it's time for the show.
The Majority Report. With Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, September 17th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Astra Taylor, co-founder of the Debt Collective, author of the recent book Remake the World, to discuss the 10-year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. Also on the program, to look back on the week in politics, Heather Parton, or Digby, from the blog Hullabaloo, and from Salon.com. Also on the program today, corporate Democrats in the House, back channel with Manchin and Sinema, to kill low-cost prescription drugs. Because, of course, meanwhile, the debt limit is 2 weeks away. And supposedly, the vote on the bipartisan infrastructure bill is 10 days away. On the COVID front, Idaho, now forced to allow its overwhelmed hospitals to ration care. And in the weeks that school has started, hundreds of thousands of children have become infected. Meanwhile, Alexander Vindman, that retired lieutenant general, or I should say colonel, calls for General Milley's resignation. Federal judge orders the end of Title 42 at the border. Speaking of which, the Border Patrol is detaining more than 9,000, mostly Haitian migrants, under a bridge in Texas. Republicans prep a big Washington rally in defense of the January 6th attackers. Not a joke. Ohio Republican congressman, meanwhile, announces retirement, citing Donald Trump as a cancer in the GOP. I think that gives you a sense of where the numbers are in this. The Durham grand jury announces an indictment and lands a guppy. Lastly, a Capitol Police officer is investigated for sharing information about the secure location of lawmakers on January 6th to the people who are attacking them. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is, of course, Friday, and that is that's the end of the week, and Emma Viglin is here.
Hello.
I want to say something profound about Friday, and then I ran out of things.
It's after Thursday Night Football?
Yeah, well, I guess. Also, Yom Kippur. So I fasted yesterday, so I'm a little bit, still a little bit out of it.
Well, between that and your food poisoning situation, I
yep.
didn't know if that was public,
yep.
Maybe you lost a little bit of weight. Not that you need to, but that's...
I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
But
I
always try to take silver linings out of those kinds of like situations. Not that I fast. Anyway, I'm a little out of it, obviously, myself.
Yeah.
So
somebody's a little bit upset about the Giants. We're not going to go into it, but people understand out there. So a lot of things happening over the next couple of weeks. I mean, we're watching the slow dissolution of the Democratic infrastructure proposal as all the talk that we heard after the Democrats won in 2020, that the squad was a liability, et cetera, et cetera. Now we're watching a bunch of corporate Dems who are servicing only really corporations. I mean, let's be honest here. Is there really a voting constituency? I don't care how purple your district is. That is in favor of higher price prescription drugs. I mean, that's the question. And
did Joe Manchin and his daughter have their own district?
Well, exactly. And it's not just Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema. There are three Democrats in the House who have been written about extensively, who are able to take down, apparently, this prescription drug element of this bill, which is so that Medicare and the government can negotiate rates for prescription drugs, the savings of which were going to be used to expand benefits for Medicare subscribers, I guess, and perhaps drop the age of who is eligible for Medicare. Should also tell you that when you start talking about Medicare providing dental for people ages 65 and over, the healthcare providers, the hair on their back starts going up because they start thinking like, oh, well, if we're negotiating with Medicare, we're going to lose money. And that's basically the dynamic that that's going on here. Now, we'll see what happens, but you know, we know that there are at least 17 Democrats who have publicly committed to not voting for the bipartisan bill if the reconciliation bill is not there at that time. And there has, as far as we know, not enough Republicans to essentially defang that threat.
Right.
And so...
And just vote for the bipartisan bill.
Exactly.
Decouple it. It would be a smart strategy for them to do that, but I don't think they have enough. They're too extreme in wanting to oppose everything that Biden is putting forward.
Yeah, and I think look, at this point, the progressives should hold their ground and sink this stuff and make everybody pay for this situation because we're in, you know, that zone where if we cannot get an entire sandwich right now, accepting a quarter of the sandwich is not enough. Here's Joe Biden delivering remarks about his economic plan at the White House. And really what he should be doing, it seems to me, is calling out these Democrats in the House and in the Senate by name and asking, bring one of your constituents over who's looking for higher price prescription drugs. Bring them to the White House. We'll give them a tour. That's what I'd like to hear him say.
Minutes ago, 55 most profitable corporations in America paid zero in federal income taxes on what amounted to $40 billion in profit. Not a penny. That's not right. My economic plan will change that. Not punish anybody, just make them pay their fair share. But my Republican friends in Congress don't want to change the law. So what are they doing? They're attacking me and my plan, which is fine. But if you're going to have a debate, let's have an honest debate. My Republican friends are attacking my plan, saying it's big spending. Let me remind you, these are the same folks who just 4 years ago passed the Trump tax cut, totaling almost $2 trillion in tax cuts, a giant giveaway to the largest corporations in the top 1%. And listen to this. Almost none of that $2 trillion tax cut was paid for. It just ballooned the federal deficit. In fact, the unpaid bills racked up by the last administration are projected to increase the national debt by more than $8 trillion over time. What I'm proposing is totally different from that approach for three reasons. First, my plan is paid for. It's fiscally responsible because our investments are paid for by making sure that corporations, wealthy Americans, pay their fair share. Second, we're not going to raise taxes on anyone making under $400,000. That's a lot of money. Some of my liberal friends are saying it should be lower than that. But only corporations and people making over $400,000 a year are going to pay any additional tax. And third, not only will no one making under $400,000 see their taxes go up, the middle class are going to get some tax cuts, some breaks. My plan benefits ordinary Americans, not those at the top who don't need the help. It's a historic middle class tax cut, cutting taxes for over 50 million families.
Personally, I think all this rhetoric is pretty stale.
You're right.
And it's all stuff that we hear before. It's completely boilerplate stuff.
You've never heard middle class tax cut before?
One wonders who this is for at this point. Like I say, none of this is new. And the only thing that even sounded even remotely decent in that, and it comes way too late, why have they not been running against the Trump tax cuts? Even if you're going to say, the Trump tax cuts were irresponsible. We're going to get rid of all of them except for the ones that tax people under, that would increase taxes under $400,000. Donald Trump is singularly unpopular in this country by at least the majority of people.
Kristen Sinema, why are you advocating for keeping the Trump tax cuts? In Arizona, a state that is like the exact kind of demo right now that this Democratic Party is targeting of, suburbanite types voting against Donald Trump.
And if you want it, if you're worried about your $400,000 one, you say the Trump wealthy tax cuts, the Trump rich tax cuts, whatever it is, come up with somebody, spend some of that money and figure out what the
Trump tax cuts for the rich.
Then. Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Right.
I mean, that's it. And there's a real feeling that actually doing politics at the White House seems to have been taking a back seat. I mean, if there's been an inside game, we're not seeing any of the
why do politics when we can just fall back on the beautiful path forward of Senate procedure? That
there you
seems
go.
To be the only thing he's committed to in this area.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Astra Taylor on the 10-year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. Folks, got a couple of sponsors today on the show. Common scenario, you need to see a doctor. You search and you find one that looks good, great. You wait on hold to book an appointment, not so great. Finally, they pick up, you rearrange your schedule, and when you finally go in, you find out doctor doesn't even take your insurance. Well, you could avoid all of that. Well, except for the part you need to see a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Just download the free ZocDoc app. It's the easiest way to find a great doctor and instantly book an appointment. So what happens is on ZocDoc, you search for local doctors, ones who take your insurance. You read verified patient reviews about that doctor, and then you book an appointment. You can do that in person or video chat. In terms of the appointment, you'll never wait on hold with a receptionist again. Doesn't matter if you need a primary care physician, a dentist, a dermatologist, a psychiatrist, an eye doctor, whatever it is, ZocDoc has you covered. Go to ZocDoc.com/majority. You download the ZocDoc app. You sign in for free. Every month, millions of people use ZocDoc, including
me,
Emma, and Bradley. You've used it, right? Matt, do you use it?
I found my dentist here in Brooklyn with ZocDoc, and she was great, and she did my fillings really well.
There you go.
A few weeks ago.
Super easy. Plug in your insurance, and you know that you're going to the right person.
Replacement fillings. My mouth is clean.
All right. I mean, when people get cavities, you don't have to feel...
Well, I have, like, internalized childhood shame about it.
All right. That's weird. Anyways, maybe you find a psychiatrist on ZocDoc, too.
Probably.
Anyway, ZocDoc makes healthcare easy. Now is the time to prioritize your health. Go to ZocDoc.com/majority. Download the ZocDoc app. Sign up for free and book a top-rated doctor. Many are available as soon as today. Do it, folks. That's ZocDoc, ZocDoc.com/majority. Also, today's sponsor, yep, Emma's favorite, Tushy.
I think it's Hello Tushy, right?
Well, it's Hello
I'm
Tushy.
I'm a Tushy lady.
Hello Tushy is the site, but it's Tushy. It's the modern bidet that attaches directly to your toilet in under 10 minutes. Super easy to connect. It has been a game changer for many people. We had an IM the other day. Someone said, like, I'm ruined now when I go into work and if I have to go. Because at home, I have a Tushy.
Mm-hmm.
And at work, I don't. Tushy is the modern bidet for people who poop, which is, as far as I know, just about everybody. Well, not everybody.
Not, I mean, Kim Jong-un.
No. Just poop, wash, pat dry. Tushy bidet washes your bum with water, which is obviously a better clean than toilet paper. Less irritating, more soothing, and cleaner. The Tushy bidet is easy to install. Like I say, it attaches to the toilet in under 10 minutes. No electricity or plumbing needed. Using a Tushy bidet reduces your toilet paper by 80%, saving you money. It is eco-friendly and it is stylish. Start washing with a Tushy bidet for a better clean. Go to HelloTushy.com. That's HelloTushy.com/majority to get 10% off plus free shipping. This is a special offer for our listeners at HelloTushy.com/majority for 10% off. After you buy and install your Tushy, show it off. Tag at HelloTushy on Instagram. Lastly, I lean on this. I've been leaning on this quite a bit lately. One stick of liquid IV and 16 ounces of water will hydrate you faster and more efficiently than water alone. I know why it is, because I had that... I had some food poisoning,
mm-hmm.
and the one thing everybody tells you, stay hydrated. And I'm like, I'm good. I am good on that. We got a lot of liquid IV in this office, a ton.
Yes, I used it yesterday.
I'm drinking some right now. I had the matcha, And I moved on to the tangerine.
I saw some pina colada stored over there.
I got the pina colada, of course. That's my go-to.
A little bit of a hidden spot, I must say.
Well, I don't want anybody taking my pina colada. The big news is we got a water cooler in the office now, and so everything has changed.
Time to dump all the liquid IV into it.
We wouldn't do that. But liquid IV tastes great. Other flavors, watermelon, strawberry, lemon lime. Sounds a little bit like summer. Pina colada sounds like summer, too. I don't know why they don't promote that. I think I might be fairly unique in that respect, but I love it. Liquid IV contains 5 essential items, more vitamin C than an orange, and as much potassium as a banana. It is healthier than sugary sports drinks. There are no artificial flavors, no preservatives, less sugar than an apple. Liquid IV is powered by cellular transport technology. It has the optimal ratio of glucose, sodium, and potassium, delivers water and nutrients into the bloodstream. The company has donated over 4 million servings in response to COVID-19. Products are being donated to hospitals, first responders, food banks, and more. Folks, you're traveling. If you've overindulged, if you're not feeling well, or you just want to stay hydrated, and frankly, you know, like this is, for me, it's more than a daily thing. I mean, I've got the matcha and the tangerine immunity boosters going right now. You can grab your Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco, or you can get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use the code MajorityRep at checkout. MajorityRep. It's 25% off anything you order when you get better hydration today using the promo code MajorityRep at liquidiv.com. Okay, I want to welcome back to the program co-founder of the Debt Collective, author of Remake the World, Essays, Reflections, and Rebellions, Astra Taylor on Occupy Wall Street. Astra, welcome back to the show. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Hey, thanks again for having me.
So, you know, I was digging around a little bit in some of our audio footage. We went down there on the 17th, I think it was, which was, if I remember correctly, was a Friday, but it was raining in the morning a little bit, and I had some big contraption that I was trying to broadcast from. We ended up getting reports from the 19th, but what are your thoughts looking back? Like, when did you I know you got there sort of like as it was just sort of becoming an occupation on some level. Just give a sense of like how it developed and what your recollection of those first days were.
Yeah, Occupy Wall Street was something I first heard about in August. I got an email from my friend, the late great anthropologist David Graeber, basically saying, hey, some activist geeks are meeting, we're having regular assemblies, they were calling themselves the New York General Assembly, and plotting an occupation of Wall Street. And they were responding to a call issued by Adbusters, the Canadian magazine, that was pretty bold. It was basically, come to Wall Street September 17th, bring tents, stay for months, 20,000 people, you know? And the people who were having these assemblies leading up to that were much more humble. You know, they had broken into different working groups, comms, like sort of tactical, figuring out what the different areas were. They found Zuccotti Park, which was their third choice for a place to camp out. And they actually had a demands working group, but they were skeptical they'd even be able to stay the night because of the police presence in New York. So that first day, I joined with everyone at Bowling Green. The police had basically shut down Wall Street. I mean, it was a police zone in there, but they hadn't cordoned off Zuccotti. And I remember marching north and in a pretty orderly fashion and saying to a young man on my right, where are we going? And he said, Zucchini Park. None of us knew of this place, you know, and we got there and it was sort of perfect because it's on Broadway. It's East Side is on Broadway, but it's also quite private. And there are all of these sort of planters that you could sit on. And people just started talking. We broke into little groups, small general assemblies with about 20 people. And we talked about why we were there. what our demands would be if we made them, and what we were going to do about the crisis of democracy that we were in. You know, the fact that 3 years ago, it had been 3 years since the financial crisis, and no bankers were being paraded in handcuffs, right? In fact, they were being brought into the Obama administration. And that was very striking to me. I mean, you've had me on the show about the work I do. I'm kind of a nerd. So the fact that we weren't standing at the New York Stock Exchange screaming, but we're actually sitting and talking and planning to be there for a while was really powerful. And I think that that feeling of assembling with others, taking space, realizing other people were mad and wanted to do something was addictive. And that's what, why so many of us stuck with Occupy Wall Street, even though, yeah, you're right, the weather was terrible. There weren't really that many people the first day. I mean, it wasn't, you know, I didn't think, wow, this is it. You know, this is the revolution. But there was something about it that made me stick with it. And so many other people did as well.
Yeah, it was fascinating. And it was, relatively quickly, there was, I'm trying to get my bearings straight, but as you come into the park, I think it was from Broadway, like on the right, very quickly, there was like a library that was started, and yes, there was a sort of commissary, and there was a comms area and there became like, you know, security. And I mean, there was all sorts of, I mean, there was sort of like two different sort of concurrent agendas. One was like the physicality of the place. And then one was sort of like the agenda of the place that was going, that were sort of commingled, but also, sort of distinct endeavors.
I think that's really true. And I think that's part of what was so powerful about it. It was both sort of the political, philosophical point we were making that you know, a lot of people at the time said, oh, Occupy, you know, it doesn't have clear demands. I mean, the demand was obvious. We were a big middle finger at the center of Wall Street, at the center of global capitalism, in the middle of an economic crisis, the greatest crisis since the Great Depression. I mean, you had to be willfully obtuse. But it also reflected being a total naivete about how politics worked. People forget this, but there had been an encampment called Bloombergville in May that lasted a few weeks that was in Wall Street, never kind of captured the public's imagination. And there was a massive demonstration in May that I attended that was 10, 20,000 people with very clearly enumerated demands. They didn't win just because they had demands, right? Occupy in a way protested everything. It was saying the whole system is broken. We need to revitalize, reinvent democracy. We need to make the 99%, you know, we need to make the 99% feel empowered. So there was that stuff, but then it was, so there were these philosophical aspects, but you're right. It was absolutely about bodies in space and also bringing back an age of defiant protest. They didn't, the planners for the occupation did not go and get a permit. At that point in New York City, and I'm not sure what the laws are now, it was illegal for 20 people to gather without a permit. So it was an illegal gathering, an illegal occupation from the start. And that was really important because it was 10 years of the war on terror, this kind of real suppression of protest. You know, if I was very skeptical we'd be able to make it through the night because, you know, I was so used to being kettled by the police and put in a free speech pen. And so there was those two things together, which was a kind of philosophical, political message, and then the embodiment of it, right? So theory and practice really together. And that was part of what was so powerful. You know, you'd go to the People's Library and get a book and read, or go to a working group and learn about finance. And then you'd go march to Wall Street for the opening and closing bell at the New York Stock Exchange.
And we should say, like, you know, I went back and listened to at least, you know, the interviews that we did. I think the first interview that we did from Zuccotti, which was Monday the 19th, and maybe we'll play a little bit in the fun half. But one of the things that struck me was like it was someone from comms, and they were saying that people had been arrested for having masks at that time, and I mean I don't know that the NYPD is, and maybe in some respects it's even more aggressive now, than it was then. But they were really trying to arrest people. I mean, they were trying to figure out what to do here, and they were really nervous about going into Zuccotti in some respects. And what do you think accounted for that? I mean, it took them a while to realize, like, maybe they thought it was going to peter out. But to me, the physical presence was so, well, ultimately, in retrospect, I think it became even clearer. But at the moment, like, the physical presence that they were there was so important, because you didn't need to create new events to get the news going. It was just sort of like, it was happening. They're not going away. And it was almost like they weren't stopping traffic, really, but they were clogging the normalcy of that area. And that's what compelled, I think, a lot of the coverage, and also just sort of like the commitment that it showed.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Why didn't they clear out Zuccotti Park that first night when they could have? And a friend reports seeing a kind of black SUV. Nathan Schneider, who was a kind of participant journalist, wrote a great book called Thank You Anarchy about this. You know, and the guy, basically, I think you're right. They thought it was going to fizzle out. And that was a mistake, because it didn't. It was a very obstinate movement. But the police, you know, were hostile right after that. And it radicalized a lot of people to see that police violence. And there's all sorts of instances that, you know, we remember. There's the pepper spraying of two young women a week into Occupy Wall Street, you know, very up close, very violent. And that footage was circulated by people, and also through the anonymous networks online, yeah, which were like a big part of the political and online discourse and scene back then. And so those images really outreached people and just pushed the public sentiment on the side of the protesters. It was illegal to wear masks. Everybody was wearing those Guy Fawkes like anonymous masks at the time. But the police violence, you know, which was not just in New York City, Occupy sprang up, and I'm trying to get a solid count, but New York Daily News, I found, had a piece that said something like 2,200 occupations at one point.
Victims. Not just in the States, should say. It was in very small places. You know, I personally was in towns with 5,000-6,000 people who had an Occupy encampment. I knew there was one in Worcester, which is a bigger city. I mean, they were across the country.
Yeah, and around the world. I visited Occupy Dublin one afternoon at a certain point. There was, you know, Occupy London. And I think, you know, people responded because, you know, the way I describe it is Occupy broke the spell. There was this economic consensus, this bipartisan consensus that the market was it. There was nothing beyond market. You know, it was Bill Clinton who had repealed Glass-Steagall, which was the Depression era reform that had separated investment from sort of commercial banking, you know, and they scoffed if you dared to question their reality, a reality that was causing such damage. The financial crisis had evaporated trillions of dollars overnight, decimated the over 50% of the wealth of Black families, over 60% of the wealth of Latin families, Latino families. And so it's just like, people were like, this isn't working, you know, and that's why you had these Occupies spring up everywhere. And, you know, it really, I think it's hard to remember today how significant that was, because we're used to protest. We're used to people talking about class. We're used to people saying inequality is bad. Now, it's gotten worse. Things have objectively, materially gotten a lot worse since then. I mean, the banking sector emerged stronger than ever because of the Obama administration's policies. But in terms of us being able to speak the truth, so we have a chance of building power to address these issues, I think we're on really different political terrain.
To me, it was a huge pivot point. I mean, having, you know, just done some iteration of this 7-8 years, I guess, prior to Occupy, and the 10 years since, there was such a radical change in terms of the way that people identified themselves, the way that they spoke about what you're talking about. You know, introducing concepts like neoliberalism and people referring to themselves as socialists, and it seems to have waned on some level, at least in terms of the 2016 run of Bernie Sanders, you could draw a direct line to the rhetoric and the ideas that came out of Occupy there. But we should also say, too, there was a mix of ideologies that were there. That there was a lot of anti-establishment, but for different reasons, I think. And some of that has become sort of clear, right? I mean, there are people who were at Occupy who have gone in many different directions. Talk a little bit about that, because I think that was both a strength. Well, I don't know if it was a weakness, but it was a strength of Occupy, and that a lot of people were able to project onto it what they wanted to, without that seemingly being things getting too stratified, I think, there.
Yeah, it's interesting. My thinking on this has evolved a bit because, you know, it's the benefit of hindsight and the fact that I've been organizing. I mean, I think first for me, you know, what Occupy did, and I know it did for so many others, is I felt so alone, right? I was so atomized. There wasn't a left to really join. I mean, why would I join a, you know, I might've been a socialist, but the groups just felt so marginal. They were, you know, selling these papers in the corner of a park, or not Zuccotti Park, but just, it felt like, it just felt, the left was so demoralized and so marginal at that point. And so, you know, a lot of tendencies flocked to that. And on the one hand, that was the capaciousness of the call, right? Anyone could come to Occupy Wall Street. It was open. It was small D, radically democratic. And the 99% is incredibly open, right? It's saying, you know, everyone but the 1% can be here. And I actually think that that was really powerful. And it did have contradictions. Its openness also led to conflict and some chaos. I mean, Occupy also didn't have any traditional structure. It rejected the idea of leadership. And what that did was allow us to be full participants and bring our full selves and be creative and come up with ideas. You know, for us, for me, it was a lot of ideas around organizing around debt and how to politicize debt. But there were all sorts of offshoots. And so, you know, the openness was generative, and then it became a bit of a liability in ways. And so I think what's interesting is how people are still navigating those contradictions and tensions. And so there was definitely, I was on the side then that it's like, I want to be a part of a left that's more disciplined and more strategic and more organized. But that, that space for people to be actors and not just like bodies showing up at a march who then are told to go home, I think is really powerful. And that's why the socialism that we see today is small D democratic socialism, right? It is trying to continue that. What was the core rallying cry of Occupy Wall Street and the movements around the world in 2011, which was about democracy, right? We want to be able to be political actors, to have a say in the decisions that affect our lives, to not be living under an oligarchy, right? To not be living under a system where only money has a voice.
Well, there's something to be said, too, about the agency that gives for all of the people participating in Occupy. I mean, I had this conversation with Dave Zirin the other day about talking about Kaepernick actually yesterday, and how he initially was sitting on the bench to protest, but then he took the knee, and it was an active choice that other high school students, college students could participate in, because it creates an act, and that in and of itself just like amplifies the activism, because you are doing something active in a way. And I mean, I think that might have contributed to the poignancy of Occupy long term.
I think those things that are immediately replicable, that people identify, right? So people also understood, just like people know what taking the knee means and how to do it, Occupy gave people these symbols and these actions. So you go to a space, you have a general assembly, you start a library, you know, you start a food distribution network, you know, and it was just enough to get people started where they felt connected to what was happening in New York and to other places, but they also felt that they could then adjust for their communities. And, you know, I think one tragedy is there's never been a full accounting or even a partial one of all of the efforts that respond in these local occupies. I mean, I've heard stories of them, right? That this one went on to defend a homeless shelter, and this one, you know, Athens, Georgia, where I'm from, Occupy basically led to a transformation of the city council. You know, I mean, there's all of these ways that those groups allowed people to take that first step of finding each other, and then they kept organizing in some way. And I think that's actually, you know, a critical thing, but it was those basic building blocks that people could take on and then iterate themselves, that I think was part of Occupy's magic.
It would be fascinating to have an accounting of all the things that sort of came out of there. And, you know, some of which, you know, not great, frankly. You know, there were people there who have gone on to just sort of like twisted their anti-establishment, ideology, and it's turned into sort of, I think, reactionary stuff, frankly. But there was, you know, so many both institutional movements and sort of more, sunrise movement, down to like local advocacy groups or, you know, people fighting for clean water in Detroit and whatnot. I mean, the breadth of all that. All right, let's just talk about one more thing, like the space, because when it ultimately, in New York, when the cops came in there, and I think they came in with like the LRADs, which was the sort of the audio cannons, and they drove everybody from the park, and they did this at like 2 a.m. And in fact, I think it was like on the night of the morning of the 15th, because it just so happened it was our anniversary show, and we did like a 24-hour show or 12-hour show that day. So we had people as they were marching a call in, and we had people talking about it. The loss of the space really ended up like dispersing everybody, literally, and the energy, it felt like.
Yeah, that was, I mean, so there had been a previous attempt to oust people from the park, and Mayor Bloomberg, whose girlfriend at the time, I doubt they're still together, was actually on the board of Brookfield Properties, which was the company that owned Zuccotti Park, which was like a public private park, which is why it was open 24 hours. So by this quirk of ownership, Zuccotti didn't close like most New York City public parks. So he said, you know, in this condescending way that also implied we were a bunch of dirty hippies who needed to get jobs, that the park needed to be cleaned. Right. And so a lot of unions, you know, made calls, and, you know, Occupy sent out through their networks and Anonymous, and 6,000 New Yorkers came at dawn and defended Zuccotti Park. So, you know, Bloomberg was rebuffed in a big way once, but then they did the late night raid. I wasn't in the park at the time, but I came the minute that a text alert was sent, and it was, you know, a militarized raid on this movement, on a nonviolent movement. And they just, you know, in addition to what you described, they had these garbage trucks and just everything in the trash, you know, and helicopters flying above. And it was symbolic to me at the time of just what a threat this was, you know, what a threat they found Zuccotti Park to be. And in fact, there was a coordinated crackdown. Mayors had had these emergency phone calls, and they were backed up by Homeland Security and backed up by the FBI.
If I remember correctly now, yes.
Yeah.
Back to me. They had all.
Yeah. And so these, you know, multiple cities had these crackdowns at the same time. Now, some of these small Occupy stayed together for months and managed to hold out, but the sort of big symbolic ones were ousted. And so people, it was a bit of an identity crisis for Occupy Wall Street. And people, I think some people really wanted to hold another space. There were campaigns to find another encampment. And you know, I was of the opinion that that was mistaking a tactic, which is occupying, for the goal of the movement, the goals of the movement were to transform the broader society. So a lot of us had been thinking this was, you know, I mean, a lot of us, not like in a small group, but a lot of people who were involved were thinking that this was going to happen. And people were already moving into neighborhoods, occupying and defending foreclosed homes. We were moving forward with our work around debt. And one way we thought about it was that how does Wall Street occupy our lives? Well, through these financial obligations, through the debts we owe them, right? So, I mean, Wall Street is everywhere. It's not just at Zuccotti Park. We need to think about finance in a bigger way. But, you know, what it did was it people had to then reckon with what had transpired there and how to build out of the ashes of it, right? Because the point was never to camp indefinitely. Right. The point was to challenge the 1%.
So, I mean, lastly, and obviously, you know, everybody who were involved at the level that you were involved in this, and we should say, like, you know, there the some of the best sort of like the financial regulation, I can't remember what the name of the committee was, but they
occupy the SEC.
I occupy the SEC. I mean, they generated what I think is if fairly uncontroversially considered the best document in terms of, you know, when the government was looking at creating Dodd-Frank, like the most comprehensive, thoughtful document that, you know, was generated in support of financial regulation going forward. I mean, so there's a lot of like just incredible work that was the products that it existed on. But what do you think needs to happen with that hindsight now, like to move things forward? Because in my sense is that things have stalled a little bit, and in part because, you know, you get Donald Trump and there is a natural tendency to be like, we need to stabilize things, and people's ambitions diminish, which I think is, you know, it's certainly a predictable reaction. I don't know if it's a legitimate one, but it's certainly a predictable one. I mean, and what is your sense of, like, you know, where, if you had the ability to generate something that, you know, just snap your fingers, what would it look like?
I think Occupy was what it had to be for the time it manifested, again, because the left was so disorganized. I mean, the left, and sometimes of its own, because of, it deserves the blame, but also because of years of suppression, years of sabotage. This is what I talked about with Emma in the last interview, you know? And so, you know, knowing the people who were part of the planning committee for September 17th, you know, it seems ridiculous to me to say Occupy failed. Those people should have changed the world and brought, you know, a true egalitarian democracy to the United States. If somebody failed in that moment, it wasn't the occupiers, it was the political establishment, specifically the Democratic establishment, that ignored the writing on the wall. But, you know, Occupy was this warning of this populist discontent, right? It was a symptom of a crisis of political legitimacy, again, because there had been this, you know, bipartisan move, you know, bipartisan decisions, and this market logic that had gotten us into this crisis. So I really think the political establishment failed yet again. We're in a much worse state. But then the onus is on us to organize, and to organize in a smarter way, in a more strategic way. And, you know, I do think Occupy created a space for people to start thinking about power more strategically, to start thinking about how you have an organization that is sustaining, that is impactful, that brings people into a multi-phase, multi-year strategy, but that is still small D democratic, that makes people, that also harnesses people's creativity and capacities. And we're having to build a lot of that infrastructure, you know, from scratch. And so you highlighted the Sunrise Movement. A lot of the kids who founded that were part of Occupy, you know, or inspired by it, but also wanted to not repeat some of its failures and foibles. And so I think, you know, we need to keep being serious about power. One thing I do think we can learn from Occupy, though, as the left gets more robust and as people start to be more open about their socialist politics and their positions, is that we actually still need to keep welcoming people. So that's where the 99%, I think, is powerful. You know, some of our policies might be popular, but that doesn't mean we have a majority of people actually organized and in movements and ready to fight for them. And so we have to keep, even if it can get really messy, and even if it means that some of the people we're working with aren't, you know, maybe as astute politically or something like that, that's what it takes to win, is bringing majorities on board. And so that, I think, is something that I look back on and think was one of the most powerful attributes of that movement. But yeah, I'm always about power strategy. We can't cede any terrain. I think people are getting better about engaging with electoral politics without feeling the only outcome is going to be co-option.
Right.
But we can actually shift the balance of power, you know? So we're learning, the left is learning, and we have to keep doing it. And you're right, there is a bit of a lag. I would also like to see, as the co-founder of the Debt Collective, attention on finance. That was a part of the thing about Wall Street. You know, thinking, you know, really critically about the economy and what lever points we might have. That's one area I'd like to see more attention paid to on the left.
Well, Astor Taylor, folks can check out your New York Magazine piece with Jonathan Smucker, Occupy Wall Street Changed Everything. People will put a link to that at majority.fm, and of course your book as well. Astor Taylor, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Astor.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Heather Parton, or you may know her as Digby. We are back, ladies and gentlemen, and our next guest needs no introduction, but we have one anyways.
She'll get one.
Yes, and it's musical. It's been a while.
Are you ready for some pee-pee-pee-pee-pee-pee-pee, yeah. And a bit of horror from the a bit of horror from the should do ya. How's that some color from the
I feel like this musical style has come back in now. Right?
I need my own sitcom with that.
I know. Did you know?
That's awesome. I love it.
On this day in 1965, I was listening to the radio and I heard that Ford introduced the option of 8-track tapes at this time. And
choosing to age yourself on the program.
Well, today. I wasn't yet alive, actually, but I do remember 8-track tapes.
I remember 8-track tapes. I didn't realize they came out that early because it was the 70s when they really took off.
The 8-tracks, early 70s. I remember. I remember those. You could get. I had some as a kid.
So did I.
But that's not why you're here, Heather. I want to welcome Heather Parton to the program. You may know her as Digby from her blog, The Hullabaloo, or the song that we just played.
It really is. Of course, such a great song. It makes me feel happy and relaxed all at once.
Me too.
There you go. So, all right, Heather, let's look back on this week. You know, the... California, you're in California. That was a big, big victory. I want to say for Gavin Newsom, but it really was a victory against the recall, right?
That's how I see it. And I do give Newsom and his team credit too for, taking a really aggressive stance against, you know, the undemocratic nature of what they were doing. Now, it's true that recalls are constitutional in California they have them in states all over the country, but California's is particularly sort of, you know, badly formatted. And it, you know, comes from back 1910 when they did a bunch of progressive reforms to root out corruption in state government, all of which is a great idea, but it's ended up having some very, sort of destructive consequences over the years, including the initiative process in general has been quite destructive in certain ways. Things like Proposition 13, which destroyed the tax base of the state, you know, back in the 70s. And this recall, they've tried to recall every governor practically. I think I read somewhere since 1960 that there's been some kind of a recall movement of every governor. But until 2003, when Schwarzenegger when they recalled Gray Davis and Schwarzenegger was successfully replaced him, that's the first time it worked. And it's the first time they actually got enough signatures to do on the ballot. Now, obviously Republicans are in this new anti-democratic mode across the country in as many ways as they can, right? I mean, this is the whole big lie organizing principle of the party now, which is just they are doing everything they can to try and suppress votes, change the electoral system, put, you know, hacks and cronies into positions of power in the electoral system. So this actually sort of fell into that basket, despite the fact that we did do this in California back in 2003. The pandemic allowed them several extra months. A judge said, because of the pandemic, you can gather signatures for four extra months, which is really what gave them the ability to do it. And I think also this idea that Republicans in the state, a minority, there's only about a third of the state is registered Republican, that they're in this mood, right? They're in this mode. Come on, you know, we're gonna win by any means necessary. And I think they were sort of agitated, got into it. And as a result, we had this recall election that was really absurd, right? I mean, Gavin Newsom's up for re-election next year.
Right.
I mean, everybody could wait a year, right? I mean, if you want to take the guy out, do it the normal way, right? I mean, and instead they spent a bunch of money, upwards of $300 million to do this silly thing. But Newsom, I think, very wisely, and I think his people recognizing that they were going to have to galvanize the Democratic base to come out because, you know, everybody's going, what election? You know, nobody even knew. They nationalized the race, and they nationalized it in a really smart way. And they went after it as a consequence of Trumpism, anti-democratic, COVID medication. You know, they went right into the heart of everything, all the things that Republicans are doing around the country, including here in California, and just basically aggressively just attacked it. And, you know, Larry Elder, the primary, front runner of the 46 people that were running, he made a good foil because he was actually a Trumper. He's a guy who's, you know, been very much on that kind of undemocratic tack and very, very right wing and extreme in many ways. So once he became a front runner, that helped as well. And they tied him to Trump. So I think that despite the fact that I wasn't ever really worried that this was going to happen. I mean, I guess if California had really been in deep, deep trouble, maybe it could have happened, but it actually isn't. California's come through the pandemic as well as anybody. And it's a big state, highly diverse, very difficult to do something like get vaccines to everybody in the country because it's 40 million people. I mean, it's a huge population, and Newsom and the rest of the state have done pretty well. The economy has suffered the same way all economies in the country suffered from COVID, but the state has a huge surplus, and you know, Newsom is doling out, you know, actual cash and money to people. He's making some progressive changes. We have a supermajority in the state legislature. I just don't think that people were that unhappy with the political leadership. There's plenty to be unhappy about in the culture. Homelessness is a horrible problem. Real estate prices are absolutely out of control. There's plenty to be unhappy about, but I didn't get the sense ever that people were blaming Gavin Newsom for this in general. So I never thought it was with this state being a two-thirds majority Democratic state, that if they could get the people, if they could get the turnout, that there would be any problem. But, you know, what this showed was that there is a way to turn out people.
Well, that to me is the entire thing, right? It's turnout, right? Because we're looking at a midterm election, which to lose both chambers or even one. I mean, certainly I would be terrified about losing the Senate. More than I would even the House at this point. I mean, because judges, right? I mean, we know, yeah. Like that's, you know, at the very least you can do judges, and Biden administration's actually, you know, relatively speaking, doing well on this. But this is, I mean, the question of turnout is really, it seems to me, the big issue. And coming on, and this is something that you and I have talked about for months now, about running against Donald Trump and the idea that Democrats have for the first time. And I don't want to credit them too much because it's fairly obvious, right? I mean, this is like just sort of,
yeah, he did,
like,
a lot of the work for himself.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the guy is like, he's like basically standing in middle of the road. You're not going to give the Democrats that much credit for hitting him. It's just, he's in the middle of the road. You can't miss him, but they're able to run against something. They're able to do negative partisanship. Not everybody seems to understand this. I want to just play these two clips for you. And, you know, Terry McAuliffe I would have imagined he was going to be a much worse governor of Virginia than he was when he was. Let's put it that way. You know, credit where credit's due. But this I also give him credit for. Here, listen to Terry McAuliffe. And this is what I find at least encouraging, that the, you know, they're like a pack of dogs. And if one of them starts barking in the right way, they all start barking in this way. And that's good in terms of outcomes. Here is Terry McAuliffe in his gubernatorial debate on Thursday in Virginia against Glenn Youngkin.
It's working together on these big issues why so many Republicans have actually endorsed me. Former delegates, Bill Kristol, one of the most conservative writers in America. Why? Terry has the experience of getting this done. And that's what we need here in Virginia, because we've got tough times ahead. And we can't go with a candidate who is too extreme. He's a Trump wannabe. He's endorsed by Donald Trump three times. He said he was honored to have his endorsement. He wants to ban abortions here in Virginia. The number one issue he talked about the entire campaign was election integrity. The big issue I'm talking about are jobs, economic development. That's how you grow, investing in education, lifting up health care. He's gone as far to say that so much of the reason I'm running is because of Donald Trump. Well, let me be clear to all you in Virginia.
Thank you, Mr. McCullough.
I'm running for you.
Okay. So he says Donald Trump's name three times in the course of 50 seconds. And it's Trump, abortion, and the big lie, which is another way of saying Trump, right? And so he gets who he's running against. And, you know, it's all negative partisanship. Yet, you know, there is that like Bill Kristol pablum. And, I you know, but here is Nancy Pelosi. And I don't know how much Nancy Pelosi is going to impact what's running, you know, who's running in the House and how they're running. Here she is the Chatham House in London. I don't know why she's in London. Here she is continuing this sort of like thinking that even 10 years ago, I felt like it was inappropriate. But never mind today. Here it is.
I say to my Republican friends, and I do have some, take back your party. You're the grand old party of America. You've done wonderful things for our country. You've now been hijacked by a cult that is just not good for our country. Take back your party. Do not let it be dominated by those who want to suppress the vote because they have no positive message to win.
Okay. All right.
She does this once a month.
Even those guys who I consider charlatans in the Lincoln Project are out there saying that that's over. There is no cult in the Republican Party that's controlling the Republican Party. There is no cohort of people who can take back the party. That doesn't exist. That whole the party is that cult. You know, there are marginal people on in everything, but they're not big enough to take back the party. There is no they there.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I don't really understand that. I mean, it's like some kind. It's like the old. Remember, they used to talk all the time about Tip and Ronnie and how yes. Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan, they used to fight like hell all day long. And then they'd get together and have drink scotch on the Truman balcony or some such nonsense. There's always this kind of, you know, this desire on the part of the political establishment to pretend that somehow this is all some kind of a kabuki dance. If everybody would just, you know, get to just, you know, not be so angry and upset at one another. And, you know, what that leads to is the idea that, you know, that the voters, what they love is bipartisanship. And of course, voters say that in polling, in focus groups and polling. They always ask, you know, do you like bipartisanship? Oh, I love bipartisanship. We want more bipartisanship. And by the way, Democrats tend to say that more than Republicans do, who have been much more indoctrinated into the idea that they're in a political fight than Democrats have because of things like Nancy Pelosi says, you know, it's not a real political fight. So they think, oh, bipartisanship is really what we want. That's not what they mean. what they want is they want their agenda to pass and they want the other side to be okay with that. That's bipartisanship, right? Both sides want that. When in reality, it's what you just said earlier. It's negative partisanship is the defining characteristic of our political era. It's tough. It's unpleasant in many ways. It's scary and dangerous. But it is what it is. And I think Gavin Newsom understood that. Terry McAuliffe understands it. I'm not sure that the political establishment understands.
All right. Well, listen, we have to take say goodbye to our Peacock viewers. For those of us watching us everywhere else, we want to hold you over, Heather, into the second half of the program. So for our Peacock viewers,
have a wonderful weekend.
Yes. And we'll see you on Monday.
Bye.
All right, so
back to brass tacks.
Now that those people are gone, we can really talk about this stuff. It is so infuriating. I mean, and that's why, like, I got to say, like, I'm encouraged that Biden went to California and said this. I mean, this is all from just an electoral standpoint. But so we'll see. I think, like, you know what? Like I say, once like the consultant class, land on something, a broken clock can be twice. You know, can be right twice a day. And so the maintaining these majorities and we're about to pivot into the limitations of these majorities is pretty important in my mind. All right, let's talk about the majorities as we're watching this infrastructure bill essentially being dismantled in front of our eyes. Stephanie Murphy, who are the other two on this committee that basically crushed the prescription drug bill in committee?
Yeah. I mean, well, it came out in a tie in the vote, right? Is that correct?
Is that what it was?
Yeah. And so it's temporarily nixed, but it's not dead. And especially because I think it would be $700 billion in the pay fors that this kind of Democrat is exactly primed to accept and think is very, very excellent.
Kurt Schrader of Oregon, Scott Peters of California, Kathleen Rice.
That's Kathleen Rice is the one who narrowly defeated Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez for this very committee seat.
Right.
And that was because leadership interfered. Or tipped the scales or made their preference known, etc. And so, like, you know, sometimes we'll have these conversations with other people on the left about, oh, committee seats, who gives a crap, right? That doesn't matter. No, this is why that matters. Like, that kind of voice versus Kathleen Rice would have made an enormous difference here.
Where is Nancy Pelosi? Oh, I know where she is. She's in England.
She's at the Chatham.
I'm sorry. She's at the Chatham House talking about how she has Republican friends. I mean, why isn't she back in Washington essentially saying, Kathleen, right now in New York Democrats are deciding what seats are not going to exist. I don't know if it's possible for your seat not to exist, but it's possible. Or at the very least, we can make your seat in such a way that, like, you know, you're going to have better, you're going to have a primary candidate challenger. Like, where is this hardball for these people? Like, this is, and if she, you know, like, look, there's two answers. One is, like, she's feckless, which I find hard to believe. The other is that she doesn't really care about this stuff. And I guess, you know, the point is like, I am now in a position where I am rooting for the progressives to sink all of it. Like, no bipartisan infrastructure bill. Like, really sink, you know, like that's where this seems to be headed, it seems to me. And this has got to be on Pelosi and the conservative corporate wing of the party.
Well, I'm not quite there with you yet. I feel as if we're watching, you know, they always call it sausage making or whatever. And I don't actually feel like I don't have a firm grasp on where this is or where it's going. My suspicion is, and I think I told you this before, I think we talked about this last time I was on. My suspicion is that the 3.5, and part of this is because I sort of trust Bernie Sanders on this, and he seems to be a little bit more sanguine than I might expect him to be. I mean, this is always a kabuki dance going on when they're doing these big negotiations. I mean, remember in Obamacare, it went on for months and months. I mean, it was unbelievable. In a big, big package like this, it's a hugely, that's so hugely consequential. Everybody plays these different roles, and you just don't know how much of it is kabuki and how much of it is real, other than people like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and Kathleen Rice. Those people, I think, are playing roles very, very sincerely, trying to, you know, destroy the good parts of the bill. I mean, that's obvious to me. The rest of it, I'm not so sure of about Pelosi and the rest. But one thing I do think is that, you know, Bernie Sanders, we know for a fact that this 3.5 trillion number isn't real. That number is the cost. Chris Hayes was talking about this on his show last week. 3.5 trillion is the cost, but they've got all these other, they've got tax hikes in there. They've got this drug bill. There's a lot of things that are in there that also raises revenue in other ways. So it's not 3.5 trillion. It's substantially less. So that's a number that was put out there and very ostentatiously put out there by Bernie and various other people that, you know, you don't, I mean, maybe he's out there going, look how much money we're spending. But I honestly don't think that was the point. It strikes me as possible, and maybe I'm wrong here, but that number was put out there for the actual purpose of allowing people like Manchin and Sinema and Rice and others to be able to say that they whittled it down to the number that it actually is. And that when you start looking at this, and this is all very arcane kind of, you know, we don't know what the CBO is going to say and parliamentarians going to weigh in and all that stuff. So I'm just putting that out there as my hopeful, optimistic take that there's more here than what we see, which is that the, you know, the corporate Democrats are basically going to destroy everything good in the bill. And it's going to end up being one of those things where they say to the progressives, you know, well, what about the child tax credit? How can you possibly vote against that?
Right.
Even though they've lost everything else in the bill, which is always the threat and the hostage taking with progressives. It's what happened with Obamacare. The main reason why the progressives gave up that fight, and they were in the same position as you just described now, we're going to take down the bill. People came to them and said, look at the Medicaid expansion. You cannot vote against that. You'll never have another chance to expand Medicaid for poor people. And the progressives sort of gritted their teeth and went along. So here we are again in that same situation. I am just hopeful, maybe hopeful, that there's more to this. Would you have Bernie Sanders as the head of the budget committee? You have, you know, other progressives much, much stronger than they were in 2009 and 2010 in the House with a big coalition that actually has some real clout and some people leading it that are saying, hey, you know, we're not going to fall for your crap again. I'm just hopeful that they have gamed this out enough to avoid that situation again. But again, I don't know. And it's intensely frustrating because just on a political basis, having the fight this way is destructive.
Absolutely.
Because you see a Kathleen Rice come in and make her big, you know, and or Manchin walk around going, oh, they're these, you know, the hippies are spending too much money again, you know, the socialists are taking over. All that does is feed into this radical right critique of the Democrats. They don't, you know, I don't know who they think they're helping here, except I
well,
think
themselves.
We know
yeah.
that they're helping, you know, their big money donor.
All right, let me just sort of like, you know, sort of just on that $3.5 trillion number. The point being that if you raise $2 trillion in taxes or in savings, that you're, the expenditure of new money, I guess, or you know, is only $1.5 trillion, just as an example. But in fact, the resolution says you can borrow up to $1.7 trillion. That's the organizing resolution of the reconciliation bill, without getting too arcane, I guess, in the process. But really, ultimately, it's what we're talking about is we're talking about redistribution. We're talking about redistributing money. So it doesn't, you know, the whether it is, you know, money that is borrowed which you know, I suppose one could argue would have more of a stimulative effect in some level, but it's not like we need the economy to be stimulated. The economy is fairly well stimulated, it seems to me, to the extent that it can be with COVID. I would like to see, you know, expansion of unemployment and et cetera, but that again, if you have $3.5 trillion worth of taxes or savings or whatnot, it's really just a question of redistribution. And it seems to me that, like, we are watching that redistribution be attacked. And you know, like, the prescription drug bill thing is really is a big issue, because it's $600 billion, I think Emma made the point, of or $700 billion of where the funding for the other things are going to come. And, you know, you're attacking drug makers, you're taking from them. You're also, when you use that money to provide Medicare coverage of, let's say, dental, you're also pissing off the dentists, because they're like, hey, wait a second. I'm used to this 65 and older crowd coming in and, you know, doing the porcelain veneers and doing all this stuff. And that's, I make a lot of money that way. And if Medicare comes in and says, like, hey, wait a second, with all due respect to the dentist too, like, I have some real questions about, you know, what is and is not necessary with some of that dental stuff.
Oh yeah.
But Medicare is going to come in is going to be like, you're not making as much. And you know, or we're not covering stuff. You know, people are going to have to go out of pocket. And we're not covering stuff in the same way. And
but I don't get that. People are going out of pocket completely now. So, I mean, you know, it seems to me like dentists will make more money in the long run, because more people who don't get any dental care at all will come in and just get the subsistence Medicare money, right? The rest of the people are going to get their veneers and their implants and their Invisalign and whatever.
You don't make the money with subsistence. That's the point.
People still do whatever. I mean,
there's only so much.
More.
I mean, I guess maybe they have, like, their hygienists. I don't know. I'm convinced that the providers, well, whether they're going to make more money or not is secondary to whether they perceive they're going to make more money.
Exactly.
And so I don't know the answer to the first question, but I do know the answer to the second question. They think they're going to get paid less. It's enraging to watch these moderates be able to do this without, like, where are the stories about the, you know, Democratic leadership is already talking to primary, you know, opponents. I mean, it's tough. It's tough to jam them here. But, you know, this is why, like, you wanted Nita Turner to win. Why you wanted those extra numbers of Congress people in there, because ultimately the leverage has to be used against the moderates. It really always does, right? I mean, anything that is has any ambition. And they tell this story that it's really about, like, keeping the progressives in check. But the progressives have a built-in built-in sort of, like, check, which is that they want to provide benefits to people.
Exactly.
And so, like, it, you know, they come in and they're like, I want, you know, these people are dehydrated. And, like, if I have to give them a half a glass of water, I want to give them as much water as possible. And whereas everybody else is like, we don't want to spare any water for any of them. And we just,
it's,
you know,
progressives are the most pragmatic in these situations of anybody. They always have been. And it's because they have a moral basis for what they're trying to do. So they can be appealed to on a moral basis. Say, look, you know, we're sorry, we've got a bunch of jerks over here who are refusing to go along with us, but we can take, you know, get half a slice here and give, you know, like the Medicaid expansion, you know, and the progressives have to do this big gut check and say, am I going to blow up the whole thing, or will I at least just take this much for the Medicaid expansion? It's kind of a hostage situation And they hold progressives hostage for because they are moral actors in politics trying to help vulnerable people who they can't, do not feel comfortable abandoning, which is just simply not true of anybody else in politics. Not the centrists, not the moderates, and certainly not the Republicans. So they end up in this situation. The only thing I can think of here is that there is an argument to be made that is just has nothing to do with morality. It has purely to do with hardcore electoral politics, which is the numbers suggest that if the progressives hold out and actually say, look, no, we're not doing it. Forget it. We're crazy left wing socialist hippies now. And we don't care about anything. We're not going to do that. If they can make that case somehow to the caucus, you could say that if you blow up Joe Biden's agenda, you lose everything, because what happens is you've got nothing to run on in 2022. You have the negative partisanship, which you and I agree is the main thing, but that's not going to be enough. You can't just sit there and say, oh, nothing worked. I mean, he got the one bill through in the middle of COVID and that's it. And he withdrew from Afghanistan and everybody had a total hissy fit over it. And it turned out to be a huge burden on his approval rating, and he got nothing else done. They can make an argument that, look, if you guys tank this bill, that's where we're at and we're going to lose everything. And probably Donald Trump will be president again in 2024. I don't know how salient that will be to these moderates. I'm not sure. I can't even figure out why they're even putting up a fuss right now over this. I mean, and the thing is that these three that are on the committee objecting to the pharmaceutical bill, they're not endangered. They're not frontline. They're not of the front line. None of them are running in districts where they are in danger of losing their seats. So this is a sincerely held belief. And honestly, I kind of agree with you about Nancy. I'm not quite sure I shouldn't call her Nancy, but on Speaker Pelosi, that, where's the thumbscrews? I mean, granted, she tends to do these things quietly, but I'm seeing no evidence of it. Maybe when they get to reconciliation,
this is the type of thing that you shouldn't be hearing about unless they needed to put on a show for their patrons. I mean, let's be clear, too. This is not a belief system. This is a transactional.
Right.
This is like,
right.
I believe it's enriching myself. And make no mistake about it. Like, the chief of staff, I think it is. Was it Peters or Schrader's former chief of staff is like literally lobbying for the prescription drug, I don't know if it's big pharma pharma or whatever it is. But I mean, this is completely transactional. And
I literally just got Heidi text from Pelosi.
You did?
For the DCCC. I don't know. Maybe she's listened to the broadcast.
I mean, the bottom line is like maybe. These guys need to do this to put on their show for their patrons to keep getting their money. But,
well, that's what we have to hope for. And that's sick.
It's sick.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here praying that they're just doing this for money. They're just doing it because they're totally corrupt and they just have to do it for money, but they don't really mean it. And at the end of the day, they'll come through.
Right. Exactly.
What a system.
Yep. Yep. America, love it or leave it.
Here we are, and you wonder about Occupy Wall Street. Gee, where'd that come from? I wonder.
Heather, as always, a real pleasure. Thanks so much. We'll be in touch, and we'll be talking more about this. We'll see.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Sam. Have a good weekend, you guys.
Bye bye.
Yep. Thanks, Heather.
All right, folks. Gonna head into the fun half.
Hi, Emma. It's Speaker Nancy Pelosi. I'd be remiss if I didn't check in with you during such a pivotal time for our country. With everything that just happened, I know there's a lot on your mind, so I'm humbly asking, will you take a brief moment to share your thoughts on my DCCC survey? Do you want me to share my thoughts?
Maybe you should do that.
What are the things that... It's so nonspecific. It's a pivotal moment, and all the things happened.
I know, right?
The things you care about?
They're
Those
happening.
Things are happening now.
And the things you don't like? They could be happening.
Yeah, so it's very pivotal. Pivoting between good and bad things, so you better send me money.
Yeah, Kevin down in the comms department is like, I don't want to have to write two emails this month.
Yeah.
see if we can just like
make it a twofer.
Do the general one and just like, I don't know, change up the questions. You think people are going to remember the different order of it? I mean, at the end, the real question is, will you give $50?
That's basically it.
Folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can keep this show surviving and thriving by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get support the free show, you get the fun half every day. So check it out. jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget the AM Quickie. You can find that, majority.fm. Scroll all the way down to the bottom and put your email address at the bottom of the front page of majority.fm. We got our Discord. We got the merch shop, shop.majorityreportradio.com. Oh, we've got the app at Majority App. You know, all the things. All the things. Check out Nomi Show, youtube.com/TheNomiKiShow. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
Yeah, this week on Left Reckoning, we talked about, well, we talked with Darna Noor about Entergy, the climate denying utility that's failing New Orleans right now. And we also talked about how Bitcoin isn't going to, you know, help Palestinians or Afghanis or Afghans or anybody else who's currently having severe trouble, like Bitcoin boosters say. So that was on Wednesday. This weekend, we have a patron show. Victor Pugy talking about how Bolsonaro had to apologize for his little stunt at the Supreme Court and what the state of the Brazilian left is. So that's for patrons, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920 is the number. See you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.